Throughout the Beatitudes, Jesus makes a very strong distinction. He doesn't say, act like a spiritual man. He says, rather, be a spiritual man.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
For several weeks now, we've been asking the question, what is a spiritual person according to the Bible? And we've looked at the Beatitudes in Matthew 5. It's been really striking to me, Jack, that a spiritual person isn't somebody who's kind of floating off the ground at all, but someone who, as a matter of fact, is very well grounded. They're the kind of person who has a clear understanding of who they are and what God wants in their life. Who they are, people that are sinners and that mourn about their sinfulness. People who really want what's good and yet find themselves failing a lot. People who are willing to forgive other people because they see themselves as in need of forgiveness themselves. Those are just a few of the examples, and I've been really encouraged by this whole series that we've done. And here you have prevailed upon me yet again
to stay there.
Yeah. We've been on Matthew 5 a long time, but you were talking about wanting to do verses 13 through 16 of Matthew 5. How come?
Well, 11 through 16, we looked at 11 and 12 last week when we looked at verse 10, which was the last beatitude, the last of the actual beatitudes in that format. But 11 and 12 begins a commentary that Jesus makes on the last beatitude. None of the others does he comment on. He just states them. But the last one he states, and then he kind of expands it and comments on it. And we got part of that commentary when we talked about it last week, but it goes on. And I've been persuaded by one of my colleagues that we don't typically see what Jesus is doing there correctly. We tend to see it in a different light, and I'm not sure that we're right about that. So it might be interesting to explore that and see if we can understand what Jesus is saying.
And you know, Jack, I don't think we have yet received a letter from anybody who has told us that their theology stinks. So this might be one.
This might be it.
This might be it, because if you're going to translate this differently or interpret it differently, then it's typically, we might have some responses in that way, and we'd sure welcome them.
Well, and we would, and I'm not sure that I'm right. I mean, as I say, I didn't start off looking at it this way, but through the teaching of my colleague, he was looking at it in a different way and has basically, for at least for now, persuaded me that this must be what's going on here. This must be what Jesus is saying. And it makes a lot of sense to me. So
let's
read
it.
Try it on.
Okay, let's read it. How about if I do the verses 11 and 12 and you do 13 through 16?
Okay.
See if we can synchronize ourselves here.
Synchronized Bible reading.
Yeah.
An Olympic event.
Yeah, okay. Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven.
So here we are starting at verse 13 today. You are the salt of the earth.
Right. Now, how did I used to look at this? I'm not sure. I may have difficulty even articulating how I used to look at this. But it really comes down to having the last verse inform this whole section. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. I think, hearkening way back to my Sunday school days, the impression that I had been left with is what Jesus is saying here is go out and be good people, and by being good people, make God look good. Does that ring a bell at all? Is that how you have thought about it in the past or have been led to think about it in the past?
I think that's pretty close.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's basically what my thinking was. Let's come back to 16 in a second. But understanding 16 that way, then, to be the salt of the earth is to go out and be good people in the midst of the people of the world. And then oftentimes you'll hear Bible teachers talk about how salt is a preservative.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are those good people, say, sprinkled throughout the citizenry of the United States of America, that will have a preservative effect on American culture and will keep it from decaying and deteriorating and becoming more and more uncivilized. It'll have a civilizing effect in this country or any culture in which Christians
are letting their light shine.
Yeah. And that's the other one. You're the light of the world. And maybe they give a different spin on what exactly the metaphor of light is, but the idea is I'm to go out. We often hear this. This is almost idiomatic in Christian culture. Go out and be salt, or go out and be light. But the emphasis is really different here, and that's what I have come to see. It's not an exhortation to go out and be light and go out and be salt. It's not an exhortation to do something. It's a statement of fact about what we in fact are. That's what he's claiming.
So the difference is don't conjure it up. Don't go and try to make it happen. But be aware that you are the salt. You are the light.
Right, that's the first difference. And we saw that already. I don't know if I commented on it, but that's already been true in the Beatitudes that we've been looking at. Often they are taken to be exhortations to go out and do something. Go out and do poorness of spirit. Go out and do mourning. Go out and do meekness and hungering and thirsting after righteousness. That it's easy to think that Jesus is telling us something to do. But in fact, what we've seen throughout the last several weeks is he's not telling us something to do. He's describing those people who have been called by God to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven one day. And he's simply characterizing who those people are and what they look like. They're not going out and doing anything. They're just being what God has made them to be by sanctifying them, by making them truly spiritual people. If they are truly spiritual, then this is how they would be described. And it's not really an exhortation to do anything except a kind of larger exhortation: repent of your unbelief and become a disciple of Jesus who will be this sort of person. I mean, in a sense, there's an implicit big exhortation to repent, but these are not individual commandments that we are to go out and exercise and act on in the world. So similarly, if you are spiritual in the way that the Beatitudes describe, you are poor in spirit, you are meek, you hunger and thirst after righteousness, you mourn, you're merciful, you're a peacemaker, and you're pure in heart. If you are that kind of person, then you will be salt, and you will be the light of the world, and so on.
Wait a minute, I got to interrupt us.
Okay.
Sorry, Jack. I see your point that all the Beatitudes are not saying, go out and be this.
Go out and do this.
Excuse me, go out and do this. But in a sense, they are. It's kind of both.
Yeah, implicitly.
And I think that's such a tug in my mind. I think people could be screaming it in their minds, too. So I need to bring this out.
Okay.
The other day somebody said to me, Christine, I can't believe it. Every time I think of a question, you ask it. So I need to ask these questions for her.
Okay.
So let's take the one, blessed are those who are merciful, just for example. A merciful person is one who is willing to extend forgiveness to another person based on their understanding of themselves as needing forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically what we said.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm only going to be a person who extends forgiveness if I'm a person who has, whose eyes have been opened by God,
right,
to see that I'm a sinner in bad shape.
Right.
And out of that, I'll extend forgiveness. But my experience of extending forgiveness can be very much a difficult action that I take. I might have to war with myself. I know last program we talked a lot about blessed are the peacemakers. A peacemaker is a person who is willing to be merciful, who, instead of getting involved in a vicious cycle, accelerating an argument between two people, I'm one who's willing to, with great effort, decide to humble myself and say or recognize where I was wrong and also extend forgiveness to the other person. Although God has given me a heart that sees my need to do that and wants to do that, He's prompted that in me very definitely, I still experience myself as acting, doing something, and doing it with great effort.
Right. That's true. The point I'm making is not doesn't negate that at all. Let's take a different example, and it'll be easier to see this. Blessed are those who mourn, for example. Is he saying, I want you to go out and make sure you mourn at least one thing a day? No, he's not. He's saying, I want you to be the sort of person who spontaneously has a certain orientation toward the brokenness of life whenever and wherever that becomes appropriate. But it's not as if he's prescribing an action, if you understand what I'm saying. He's describing a person who is a certain kind of person who spontaneously responds to the brokenness of life in this particular way whenever it confronts him or her. But it's not like, you know, it's not like if I go 2 days without mourning anything, mm-hmm. You're not obeying the Beatitudes. That would be a very inappropriate way to think about it. In the same way, it's true that if I go 2 days without being a peacemaker, I'm somehow disobeying the Beatitude.
You're saying it isn't as though I have a list of things I need to do.
Right.
I need to remember to mourn, to forgive, to hunger and thirst for righteousness, and I need to go through each one of these and decide if I've done them or not, kind of like a checklist.
Right.
That's not it at all. You're saying God is making me into the kind of person when the situation arises where I could either be contemptuous towards somebody or a situation, or I could mourn the reality of something that is sad or that I've lost. I'm going to become the kind of person who does mourn.
And does so spontaneously. Now, spontaneously, but not necessarily gracefully.
Or easily.
Or easily, exactly. Spontaneously in the sense that it's such a reality within me that ultimately that reality is going to win out. I just am somebody who's weeping the brokenness of the world. That's a basic underlying commitment. I just am somebody who's so committed to being merciful that I really can't, in the final analysis, keep myself from being merciful. But I do have other forces within me going the other direction that war with that. That's true. And so sometimes it's a process that is a real struggle, and it does not happen easily at all. But if I'm a child of God, that this thing that has been born within me from God is such a reality with such substance that it can't help but manifest itself in my life.
It ultimately comes around, and if you see me at age 20 and at age 60, I've become a person who looks a lot more
dramatically different,
like this, yeah. These Beatitudes.
Exactly, precisely.
Okay.
Yeah. So what he's doing is describing the spirituality that God is committed to producing in me. It's not describing something that he wants me to do for God. He's describing what God is committed to doing in me, and here's what it's going to look like. And it'll look like this perfectly when he's done, but I'm in process right now. So,
and he's doing it in me, but I experience myself as very much being in the process of working it out also myself.
In terms of resolving inwardly, what am I really committed to? What do I really want? I think the example you gave last week of your fight with your husband and getting up and asking yourself the question, what kind of person do I want to be? I mean, that's where the warfare happens, not at the level of actions. See, what if you had...
I could have just said, okay, I'll just decide to act like a forgiving person, so I forgive you, Larry.
Exactly.
Or just because I think that's an action, it's something on my checklist, I better not go to bed angry.
Bible says not to.
Bible says not to do that, so I'll just obey that rule. And you're making a contrast between that and having this inner desire to want to be a person that wants God.
Exactly.
And out of that wanting of God, there's certain things that flow out of me. I may never read the Beatitudes or never read the Bible, but God would still create in me this desire to be a peacemaker.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right.
I would be that.
Because that's just what God's going to do in his children. He's just going to accomplish these things.
That's just his work. And I think you're making a real distinction here, because what we do, and I know certainly what I did early in my Christian life, was come up with a checklist of things that I needed to do, rather than having knowing that God was going to create something new inside of me. And I don't think some of those things are bad to do. It would be right for me to not go to bed angry. But it's real easy to fool myself into thinking, well, I've done all that's important now, and that's not true at all.
Right.
I was talking to someone who said that they practice being thankful, and I really like that idea of someone just deciding to be thankful. I would love my kids to practice being thankful. Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But I wouldn't like them to practice that apart from also the recognition that I wouldn't want them to think that was all that was necessary. I would want them to have truly thankful hearts, and maybe some of that thankfulness will come out of an orientation toward disciplining themselves to see things differently. But it's not just an action that can be very shallow.
Yeah.
It can really lack substance and depth.
Because I spent a lot of my Christian life not practicing thankfulness, but practicing acting like I was thankful. And not practicing mercy, but practicing acting like I was merciful. And that's not the same thing.
Yes.
Acting like I'm merciful is just conforming my external behavior to a certain set of values, but it's not resolving anything in my heart that needs to be resolved, mm-hmm. that needs to be changed, altered. My whole orientation from deep within myself has to be changed if it's going to be true spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just what the Bible calls hypocrisy. Acting the part, like a character in a play, acting the part of somebody without being that person. Well, God wants to make me into these people, not write a script for me so I can act out the part of playing these people, but actually be these people mm-hmm. that the Beatitudes describe.
And it's good to be willing to, say, not hurt somebody back in the midst of your process of learning what real mercy is and having your heart changed to be a merciful heart. It's a good thing to not beat you up in the meantime. But sometimes I think we get really lost with that being the end, and we forget that that's not really our heart. We're just, I think, like you said, acting like it is when it really isn't.
And I imagine you see this a lot in the counseling office, that Christians have been instructed, don't hurt people back, exact revenge on your husband or your wife or whatever. And so they don't, but they don't really resolve to be merciful, And undoubtedly, that anger, that hostility expresses itself somewhere else in some other way. They really haven't gotten rid of it. They have just kind of channeled it to a different place and to a different expression. And it doesn't really ultimately solve any of the problems of their sin.
Yeah, because what they think is they're supposed to act like a particular kind of person. They're supposed to act submissive, for example, to their husband. Well, this woman may be full of bitterness, but because they need to act submissive and because they need to not be angry, that's, you know, some things they're really trying to hold to, then what they do is they end up gaining 150 pounds because they're rechanneling it into something that gives them comfort in another way. Or they might burn their husband's toast accidentally, unconsciously, on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Or be slow or be late or be rigid.
Distant.
Withdraw. They might be passive-aggressive in some way, and in a way that blinds them to the reality of what the original issue was.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult then to kind of go through the many layers of getting down to what's really going on inside of you,
mm-hmm.
such that all these things are occurring. And it doesn't look very spiritual for people when I start trying to look at, okay, let's look at the fact that you really want to authorize what your husband watches on TV. Well, they'll defend it. They'll say, well, obviously God would not want my husband to watch such and such a program. And so it's right for me to let him know about that. And that's part of me being a good wife. Well, perhaps, but perhaps that's just a way of saying, I'm really, really angry at you husband, and I'm going to find a way to get back at you, but I'm not going to do it directly. And they fight to the death and justify their right to tell their husband that this is a bad television show and lose the sight that they need to have about what's really going on in their life. They're bitter. They're angry. They're not submissive.
Mm-hmm.
They're not merciful people.
Mm-hmm.
They've just decided to be that way and created more problems, many more problems along the way.
Right. Yeah. And we've hidden the real problem from ourselves so deep that we don't even see that that's the real problem. Really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I do as a counselor a lot. I kind of excavate to find the real problem. And, of course, the real problem always lies in the reality of our sin.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what we need to see about the Beatitudes is that's what I mean by saying it's a description. He's describing the person who's resolved these issues at the deepest level of their existence. And that's true spirituality. And they've made important decisions about what they want their life to be all about and what they want to emulate and what they value and what they respect. And that's become a true defining characteristic of their innermost being. And granted, ultimately, only God can produce that in us, can bring it about that we would resolve our will and our mind and our heart to be these kinds of people. But that's the true spirituality, not the external acting like these things are true, but the actual being true of these things about my innermost being. That's what he's describing.
Okay. But Jack, why does he... Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So why does he say, for example, in verse 15, nor do men light a lamp and put it under their peck measure, but on a lampstand it gives light to all who are in the house. He's talking about it being hidden, and it's also talking about the salt not being salty. It's like, are we these people and then we can lose it? We're these kind of people who are truly spiritual, who are truly been given a new heart by God, and then we lose it? Kind of sounds that way.
Yeah, it can. In all of these, here's the second, I can't remember how we defined the first one, but here's the second way in which I'm looking at this differently now. Well, the first one was there, it's not really just a command, something to do. It's not what He's not telling me to go out and be salt. He's saying you are salt. Not telling me to go out and be light. We are light. The second thing is the salt of the earth, the light of the world, is not a question of how good you are. It's a question of how exposed you are, how obvious you are, how vulnerable you are because you're not, how unconcealed you are. Maybe that's the best way to put it. Notice the one, a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. I mean, the imagery is you're a traveler traveling down the road, and you've got this city up on top of a mountain. Everybody for miles and miles and miles around can see it. You're not going to go unnoticed. You are very noticeable. All of these things, I think, are commentary on verse 10, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The fact of the matter is, as children of God, as disciples of Jesus, we're not going to be able to hide. We're going to be very exposed and very noticeable by the world because we are so distinctive. That's the imagery of the salt, I think. If someone puts salt in your food, you know that there's been salt in your food because it's such a distinctive, obvious, noticeable flavor. And likewise, if I am one of these people that God is creating to be described by the Beatitudes, such that I can be described by the Beatitudes, I'm going to be a very distinctive kind of person in this world. I'm not going to be able to kind of melt into the mass of humanity and go unnoticed in order to escape persecution. You see the point? That's what we would want to do. I mean, there's something in us that would love to hide. Something in us would love to conceal myself so that the people don't notice that I'm a disciple of Jesus. And what he's saying is that can't happen. I mean, if you really are a disciple of Jesus, then you really will be distinctive, and you really will be obvious, and you really will be exposed, because you're going to be so radically different from everybody around you. You're going to stick out like a sore thumb, and you're going to be fair game for the ridicule and the mockery and the hostility and the violence of the world against God. You're going to be a target for their hostility. It's just going to be that way. It has to be that way. So I think that's what he's saying when he says, you are the salt of the earth. And then he says, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? I mean, he's kind of saying, you are the salt of the earth, unless, of course, you're not. Which is to say, unless, of course, you're not described by these Beatitudes at all. Unless, of course, you're really not a disciple. Unless, of course, you're really not a child of God. But if you really are a child of God, then you're salt. And if you're salt, you have flavor. If you've lost your flavor, you're not salt. I mean, you can't have it both ways, which is what the fear in me would want to have. Jesus, can't I be a disciple and hide too? Can't I be a disciple and look like everybody around me at the same time so that I don't stand out? And essentially what he's saying is, no, can't have it both ways. Either you're a disciple of mine and you're fair game, or you're not a disciple of mine, but you got to choose. It's going to be one or the other. So you were asking about, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. I think what he's saying there is, think about your common ordinary experience for a second. What is it that is the nature of a lamp? Do you light a lamp in order to cover it up so that the house is dark? Such that the house is dark? Isn't the whole point of having a lamp is to set it on a lampstand in order to bring light into the whole world? You need to recognize that the purposes of God are such that he's creating you into this distinctive kind of person that the Beatitudes describe, not in order that you could be hidden in the mass of humanity, but in order that you would be obvious and transparent and noticeable, and indeed one who exposes the darkness around you. That's why you have been lit. That's why you have been made, reborn, recreated into the new man or new woman that you are, precisely in order that you would be different from the whole world around you. Just as a human purpose in lighting a lamp is to expose the darkness or light the darkness, God's purpose in recreating you is to light the moral darkness and spiritual darkness around you. It is not at all in keeping with his purposes to let you hide, you know, to protect you from that darkness by sticking a peck measure over you. That's completely in at cross purposes to what he wants to accomplish by making you his child at all. But the implication is, then you're going to have to be courageous, because the only way to be a light is to be exposed. The only way to be a light and fulfill the purposes of God in recreating you is that you be right up there on a lampstand for all the darkness to see. And you'll be exposed and vulnerable and a fair game and all that. So the question then is, when we get to 16, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Is he saying, go out and do good? I don't think so, not fundamentally. What he's saying is, have the courage to not hide. Have the courage to not cloak yourself. Have the courage to be who you are and not try to conceal who you are. And by who you are, who God is creating you to be. Don't out of fear of persecution seek to conceal that from people. Just let yourself be exposed. Be a person who hungers and thirsts after righteousness. Be a person who's poor in spirit. Be a person who's merciful. Be a person who's pure in heart, with courage, with forthrightness, with integrity. Don't try to hide it or conceal it. You'll be tempted to do that because you're not going to gain any points with the world for being that person. They're going to hate you for it. But his exhortation is, but be who God is making you to be.
So this could get interpreted as, to be a light on a hill, what I need to be is a person who is always evangelizing. I need to press my church into a very evangelistic ministry. In fact, maybe I'll make that the purpose of my church, because this is what it's saying. It's saying, let's put our faith up on a lampstand, and how better can we do that than to evangelize the world in a particular way?
Right.
What would you say to that?
Well, it's not that I'm against evangelism. I think evangelism is pretty important, but it's not what Jesus is saying here. This is not an exhortation to activism of any sort, either social or it's not helping the poor, it's not feeding the hungry, it's not transforming society, nor is it evangelism. It's not activism. It's the courage to be spirit, to be truly spiritual people. The courage to be that in the face of a hostile world. So the way to be the light of the world in the way that he's describing is the everyday mundane decisions that we make of choosing to resolve that I want my life to be all about loving God, loving his truth, loving his value system, and committing myself to that in the nitty-gritty everyday choices that I make in my interactions with people. That's more what Jesus has in mind than this kind of aggressive activism toward the world. Not that I'm necessarily against that, but I'm just saying that's not primarily what he's interested in. It's not at all what he's interested in here.
In this particular passage.
In this passage, yeah.
So what you're doing is you're making a very big distinction between hiding or concealing my faith and having the courage to expose what my values are, what's important to me, who I am, what do I think about God, what my faith is all about.
Mm-hmm. So let me give you a real specific, concrete example. I'm in the office, and an office partner comes up with a real dilemma. I've been living with my girlfriend, and you know, I don't know why, but I've just been thinking about that, and I've been feeling kind of odd and awkward about it. I'm just not sure that I should be doing that. What do you think, Jack? Now, at that point, I could either be really forthright in what I think about it and get into a conversation and a dialogue about what I actually really think about that and explore different aspects of, you know, wherever the conversation would go. Or I could decide, man, he's really going to know I'm weird if he knows what I really think. And so basically don't answer the question. I mean, dodge the question or put it off or avoid anything but being really forthright, giving a direct and forthright answer to this question about what I really think. I think we can all appreciate the temptation that we have to dodge the question. You don't really want to know what I really think, or at least I don't want you to really know what I really think here, so I'm not going to answer that question and use one strategy or another to deflect the question. So that's what he's getting at, I think.
But what people could do with what you just said is, aha, here's a formula. If someone comes to me in my office and says, what do you think I should do about living with my girlfriend, Jack? Then I always be forthright and tell them exactly what I think. And so I'm going to expand that a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that the background in my head needs to be, okay, am I going to hide or conceal, or am I going to be courageous? Okay, if I decide as a believer that I really want to be courageous, then the next question is, how do I do that? And it may look different with different people. It may be that this person I recognize has such an open heart to wanting to hear that I might at that point say, it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at how it's wrong. Let's look in the Bible. Let's talk about the impact on your life. Let's do whatever looks like it to help them look at it in a way that looks like it would help them understand, looking at their particular way of thinking or with their particular personality. How can I help them see best? And that might have 50 different kind of approaches.
Right.
It could also be that I'm discerning that this person really wants to hear, but I recognize that they're kind of resistant people, and they don't really want to hear directly. Maybe they're people who want to figure things out on their own. Maybe they're really good at that. Maybe I think that they'll get it better if I lead them into a discussion, if I give them a safe place to listen to themselves, then maybe they will come to the conclusion better that way. And that's very often the best approach. But underneath, I haven't decided to skirt the issue. I haven't run away from it. I'm not concealing or I'm not hiding. But I'm approaching it in such a way that I think it will best help the asker
right.
to hear.
Right.
And I can fool myself and say, well, I'm just listening to them. But I'm really trying to hide. And that's really what the issue is. Bottom line, am I hiding or am I being courageous? And I think that's a great distinction. I have a model that I work with, and that's the distinction I make for people all the time. In your interactions with people, are you going to be courageous? That is, in essence, are you going to be a spiritual person?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to be a person that's not spiritual, that's hiding? And the way I interact with people all the time kind of demonstrates that. It brings that up to the surface.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that we always need to use wisdom and discernment in the particular situation that we're in. Sometimes the questioner is just trying to bait you. And Jesus did not give direct answers to people who were baiting him. And neither do I think we necessarily have to. When we recognize that all they're doing is baiting me, then maybe all I need to do is smile and not answer at all. That's where we just need to be wise and discerning and understand what's behind it. In the scenario I suggested, I was assuming your first scenario, that there's I sense a real openness, that they're really asking serious questions and are asking for serious answers and have come to me for some answers. Then give them to them. Right? They're open, they're asking. Yeah, they may think I'm the oddest duck on the planet, but I am. So have the courage to admit that and to acknowledge that, because they may decide they want to become an odd duck with me,
mm-hmm.
and that they're open enough that that's a very real possibility. So I should be straightforward.
I've said this probably a number of times in this program, but I feel like I come up against that. Not I feel like, but I do come up against that decision. Am I going to hide or be courageous in my work all the time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People want me to agree with their wrong behavior or their poor decisions, or they want me to make their husband or wife the bigger problem or their child the only wrong one. And for me to really discern how to tell them, and first discern, you know, first decide, am I going to be courageous? I mean, overall, I've decided in my life I want to be a courageous person. I want to be a spiritual person. I want to pursue God. And yet, each decision is a new one.
Mm-hmm.
There is, for example, I work with people in lots of different churches. And I recognize whenever I put myself out there, I'm in danger of this person going back to their pastor and saying, you know what? This is what Christine Barber thinks, and let's not refer anybody to her again because da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, it could just be because they don't like the answer I gave them. They don't like to have to look at themselves. They don't want to have their sin exposed. But I keep on thinking, well, you know, I really want to tell people the truth, and if I don't, then this work that I do has absolutely no meaning. So, okay, so if eventually I don't have a job, that will be really, really difficult for me because I really want to be able to pay my bills. But what's more important to me, it's telling them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It comes also in terms of the referrals that I get. There was a lesbian woman who called me that wanted she and her mate to come, her partner, to come and do relational counseling to help me work toward making them a better partnership. Well, I have to turn those people away because although I work very well with lesbians or gay people and helping them take a look at themselves and recognize areas of sin in their life, and I can't do that. I won't do that. And yet what that does is it leaves me in a place where I didn't get that referral.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, it takes a very, it's where the rubber meets the road for me all the time in my work.
That's what he's talking about here. And that manifests itself in our lives in a lot of different ways every day. This is shifting gears a little bit, but before we run out of time, this is so radically different from the impression that I had of what Jesus is saying here. And what I think I hear in other people's interpretation or comments on this passage, which is kind of the mentality that what God wants us to do is to go out and be good people, and so that we can stand up before the world and say, come to Jesus so that you can be good like me. I came to Jesus, I used to be like you, I used to be sinful, I used to be weak, but I came to Jesus and he forgave me of all that and empowered me to be the good person that I am right now. That's really deadly, because look at the spirituality that we have just been had described for us in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It's a person who's truly described by the Beatitudes could never stand up before the world and say, emulate me. I am really a wonderful person. Emulate my faith. Emulate my hope. Come and have the same hope that I have, and come and rejoice in the same mercy of God that I'm rejoicing in.
Or emulate my poor in spiritness.
Yeah. Emulate my insight into my enlightenment, into my true nature.
Mm-hmm.
But don't be like me.
Yeah.
I mean, you are like me, and I'm sorry about that. But I am nothing to emulate. I am a broken person, not a successful person. But I, from a lot of different places, I was encouraged to think in terms of seeing myself as performing and demonstrating my moral prowess for people, and then telling people, follow me, be good like me. And often verses like this, be salt, be light, let your light shine before men, so that in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, is often used to support that kind of mentality. That's just wrong. I mean, that's almost diabolical in how wrong it is.
It is so wrong, and yet, Jack, it is so subtle. I think it's, at least it's kind of subtle to me. Maybe because I was taught so much this other way that I really kind of soaked it in. and it's hard for me to be able to describe it in this new way.
I lost on the other way and the new way. Which is the other way?
The other way was I thought when I became a Christian that I was supposed to then go out and show people how different I had become.
Right, okay.
And say, I want you to, in essence saying, I want you people to be like me, this good Christian. And that's what would kind of draw people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not at all what it's saying. But it's hard to make the distinction between I want you to have my faith. I want you to have my brokenness. I want you to see yourself as a sinner as I see myself as a sinner. I want you to work at the struggle of forgiving, at the struggle of being merciful. I hope that you're sad about the reality of sin in yourself and other people and in the world. But those things are kind of downers.
Mm-hmm.
They're difficult things. They're, as we've said in the past, they're ironies. So why would anybody want that? But you know what's true is that there are people that really want that. In fact, people who have been struggling for years to try to act something different or try to be very, very good are often very encouraged and relieved to hear, oh, finally they get it. And this gospel they just want to embrace with all their heart because it is a resting place for them.
Right. Well, that's exactly what I think Jesus means in verse 16. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. It sounds almost in contradiction to everything I'm saying about this passage, because what I'm saying is he's talking about how vulnerable you are to persecution. Well, that they might glorify your Father who is in heaven. But I think what he's talking about is have the courage. I mean, notice this is in the context of men don't light a lamp and put it on a lampstand in order to cover it up so it can't be seen. They put it up there exactly so that it will expose the darkness. That's why God is doing in your life what he's doing in your life. Not because he wants it to be concealed, but because he wants it to expose the darkness. Most of the darkness is going to hate it, but there are those within the domain of darkness who are being called to the light, and those are the people that verse 16 is talking about, I think. The possibility exists that there are men out there, people out there, who will see your good works and will glorify your Father who is in heaven. And they'll glorify him with thanksgiving and with gratitude and by actually being born again as well, by being one, coming to be someone like you. I think that's what he's saying. That's your purpose. That's why you have to have courage. That's why you have to fulfill the very purpose for which God lit you as a lamp to start with, is so that those people out there who will glorify God in the end, can your life can be a catalyst to their doing that. As they see the miracle of God transforming you, they will want that miracle for themselves. So when he talks about the good works, what are the good works? It's the things that you just described. It's not going out and being morally good people. It's going out and being people who are enlightened enough to know that they are evil, to know that they need forgiveness, to mourn, to grieve, to hunger and thirst after the righteousness that they do not have, to be merciful and peacemakers because they recognize all that, and to be pure in heart in their longing to be transformed one day into the glorious person that they are. But you don't demonstrate your good works by being glorious people, because we're not. But we demonstrate the good works that God has performed us into making us those enlightened people that the Beatitudes describe.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college, or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers. If you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber for the conclusion of today's program.
Well, just for a few minutes, I'd like to turn to you, the listeners, and talk to you directly. Last week, we had a board meeting with about six of us from Christianity at Work, and in walks one of our board members with reams and reams and reams and stacks of paper to give to each of us. And what they were was responses from you, our listeners, responses that we really sincerely appreciate. Some of them were letters that people have sent, and some of them were calls that people had made requesting tapes and making comments about how they felt about the program. And our board member asked us to just read through these and look at the responses and talk about what we want to do for the coming year. It was an overwhelming experience for me as I saw many, many people giving us positive reflections about this program. It was really heartwarming. We went around the room then, and the board member asked us, how do we feel about continuing? What do we think about it? And I have to tell you guys that I have an overwhelming sense of wanting to continue this program. I feel that we are in some unique ways able to reach into the lives of some people. One of the ways that I've really worked at doing that is to be honest about my own life. I think that it's such a tragedy that we go around talking about our lives as though we're really put together. That doesn't even fit our theology. Our theology is that we're sinners. We need to share our sinning. We need to share where we fail in order to encourage each other who also are failing and think they are alone. Not that we try to sin in order to share it, but that we just talk about honestly the reality of our lives. We want to request you, our listeners, to give to our program, to give financially to our program so we can continue our ministry.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.